Hello, everybody, and welcome to this version of Iconocast. I have a very special guest, a previous guest, Laurent Penet, who is a friend of both Greg and mine, and he lives in Guadeloupe in the Caribbean. And we want to talk about some very important issues that are related to both science and culture and the changing climate, as well as other issues here. One of the confounding things about science is that it's really sometimes hard to build a strand of what cause and effect are, whether it's climate or other issues that come about. And so working towards finding solutions can be pretty complicated. And so we can't just look at one issue and say, okay, well, this is what's going to fix it, or this is what's causing a problem. We have to look at pretty much the gestalt of the world and put together different focuses of science. So being an agricultural expert, Laurent Penet can work with looking at various aspects of how agriculture is affected by climate and human activity. And Greg looks at how science affects human activity. So their science is culture and culture is science, and they're all interrelated. And that's why it's always enjoyable to talk to and listen to these two gentlemen talk to each other. What we wanted to start with was the work that Laurent does in the diverse cultures of fruit trees and trees in islands and what we can learn from that. I'm going to go ahead and let Laurent do a bit of an intro on some of the work that he's been doing lately. Welcome, Laurent.
Welcome. Nice to be here. Well, yeah, so I suppose I must present a bit of what I'm working on currently. But before that, I need to put two disclaimers. The first is that I'm really discussing with you science and agricultural science as a citizen of the world. And the opinions I'm going to tell or speak about are not necessarily representing the opinions of my employer, and that I need to say they might be the same, because actually I feel like I'm very close to my institution regarding the strategy that it's taking regarding the agriculture challenges. So that was the first disclaimer, but I'm required to say it. The second one is more personal, is that I'm a huge fan of science, and of course I'm a scientist too. I'm not necessarily speaking all the time about the evidence-based perspective. I have opinions, and I can form them by experience. And that's an important part of the job, actually. And sometimes it's based on observations and intuition, and it's not yet proven. And things, well, it's we still have to make discoveries or to detail or to describe and to experiment. But sometimes we can form opinion before we have a level of evidence that are high enough. Sometimes I'm just expressing opinions. And not necessarily based on science and evidence. And that's an important part of the subject, because discussing, well, that's the way science works. And as a short disclaimer, I'm sorry, it's a bit stormy here today. And so the chickens are close to home and they might contribute to the debate. Well, yeah, so lately I've been on a project trying to record the diversity of fruit trees, I take both into account, because sometimes the trees produce vegetable leaves, but sometimes it's fruits. And I want to record both and see how they are structured in the Caribbean region, with the aim of, well, first describing what's here and what are the resources that can be used in agroforestry locally. I started the project a few months ago, and we are currently at a good stage of sampling, and that's interesting, because we begin to see things even if we did not proceed to the analysis. But that's something I might be willing to discuss a bit.
You know, I really appreciate that your second disclaimer a lot. I'm very familiar with your work, and I know that that's where your work exists. It exists at this edge between human experience, which isn't necessarily easily observed as we might observe in science, you know, how a cell works or, you know, some other thing. And at the same time, using scientific approaches to understand what you're seeing. And to me, the biggest difference between like laboratory science and this kind of work, the human ecology that you do and that I do, is context. And sometimes it's the framework that the phenomena you're looking at emerge in may cause that phenomenon to look different in one place or another. And our audience is primarily an American audience. And I will defend Americans right now. Everyone knows or claims Americans are lousy at geography, but we're not. We all know the Pacific Ocean is out in one direction. We can point to the Atlantic Ocean, and we all know where Mexico is. Beyond that, that's thousands and thousands of miles of geography. So that's we have to get credit for that. But I just want to sort of give people some context here. If you look at a map of the U.S., there's Florida. Everyone knows where Florida is, and that helps define the Gulf of Mexico, which is a big sea that we all know about because Texas, Louisiana, Alabama, Florida, and so on, or Mississippi are on that. And then to the lower right, most people know that's the Caribbean, which is circumscribed by Cuba. Increasingly, people understand the Dominican Republic, Haiti, Hispaniola, Puerto Rico. They know where that is. And then over to the right is a string of islands, originally volcanic islands, known as the Leeward Islands or the Lesser Antilles. And that defines the right side of the Caribbean. And it is down in that region where Guadeloupe is, where you live and work, right? So people, I don't know, just so people understand, these are very small islands. You are working in French territory. You use a euro, do you? In your,
Yes,
yeah,
these are
so.
French territories. There are two French islands in the region, Guadeloupe and Martinique. And so there are also, all the region, it did change a lot in a very short period of time. So sometimes it was French, sometimes it was Brittany, sometimes it was the Netherlands. And the Spanish didn't really establish there, but still. The history of the Caribbean is really a mess. Like sometimes it was for a few weeks under French administration, and then it changed to Britannic administration. So the recent past is a bit messy. And in the end, it stabilized, and it's still having a lot of consequences because economically speaking, the French islands are connected to Europe, while the English islands are connected to either Canada or the USA. And this has importance, if only regarding the electricity you use for your everyday devices, but also the way who you sell your agricultural products and what kind of products you are selling. And well, we are still, I think there is I would say, the willingness in the Caribbean to be considered, a region per se with its own cultural. So we are really there is a willingness to integrate all islands into some federation of islands, maybe not politically, but every island is just well. There are many people willing to do that, but. It's probably a bit complex to do, and we should start slowly, but I think the willingness is here, and it's important.
Yeah, and yeah. Also, I want to give a sense of size also. Mike and I are coming from, we're in different houses right now, but we both live in the Twin Cities in, St. Paul, Minneapolis, in Minnesota. And if I were to drive to Mike's house right now, it would be more miles than I would drive or fly to go from one end of the island of Guadeloupe to the other. The entire island fits comfortably within Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Yeah, geographically speaking, in terms of space, it's not far at all. But to get from one point to the other, especially with the current level of of traffic, it can take quite a lot of time. So it's the feeling of space, even if it's very short, it's actually long because you have to drive. To one place to the other. And well, so it's much more reduced. The everyday distance that you can travel is a bit reduced. And when you plan to go to the other part of the island, because Guadeloupe has two parts, it's
Gotcha.
actually a union of two different islands. One is very flat on the and calcareous, and the other is a volcano and mountain chains. And so one is dry and the other is wet, and it's very different. But you, if I want to plan to go to the other part of the island, I need to decide when I go, because the traffic jams are something you want to avoid. And this is also true for other islands. Sometimes it's really like, yeah, these are small roads, so even and it has consequences, because in St. Lucia, for example, if you are bitten by a snake, the hospital is very near, but in terms of transportation, it's several hours, so you can die before that. So yeah, geographically, it's a very constrained. It's highly mountainous, and usually it bears the history, like why the road was here in the first place, how was the ground occupied by humans, and we are still. Each island has its own specificity, but it's really constraining locally. I mean, yeah, and it was it in a way it was made at a different time, and we are still paying the consequence today, because the modern world is a bit different. And yeah, it has consequences, sure.
And you're okay, yeah. So and your work with thanks for that. That's really important context, I think. Looking at, I mean, it's also true that it takes forever for me to like to drive back and forth because of traffic. But we are not on two separate islands, separated by, connected by basically one or two roads. It's way different. And your work with diversity in fruit trees, where have you been doing that work?
Yeah, well, so currently we have sampled both French islands of Guadeloupe and Martinique, and we also have sampled Saint Lucia, Saint Vincent, and partially Barbados. And the plan, yeah, so we have colleagues with whom we work, and we since it worked very well and we see it's important, we will try. And that's a bit difficult because we did not anticipate, and we are not funded for that. But we will try to sample Grenada and Dominica, and so
Wow.
the two other islands are smaller and a bit northern. It's Antigua and Saint Croix, which is very next to Puerto Rico. That's basically what we aim for, and we are nearly halfway. And well, even with a small, yeah, we have not completed the whole work, but we begin to see differences in terms of species, the relative frequency of the species, and how people use the species too. Last time, for the previous podcast, I was just saying that, well, people don't use mango anymore. That's true for Guadeloupe, but that's not true for the other islands. It's really amazing. In Saint Lucia, there are maybe four times more mango trees than in Guadeloupe, but you would have a hard time trying to pick a mango, because it just people use it. There is no fruit on the ground, or it's very uncommon to see a public tree with fruit on the ground. So there is a huge variation, both in terms of frequency of species and how we use it. We have not really investigated, because it's really a starter as a project. It was really, well, we are just beginning to record species and frequencies and see how it's they are, well, how they fit into the different islands. But use is another part of the project that we might be willing to work on, because there is probably something to do about that too.
So are you at this early stage, excuse me, at this early stage, are you starting to see the kind of patterns you might expect for the basic ecological model, like larger islands have more species, or are you seeing what do you think the main, and this is really early, it's probably too early to say with any definitive idea, but are you starting to come up with hypotheses about what drives the variation you're seeing, what explains the variation you're seeing?
Well, we were thinking there would be variation relating to the environment. in the climate, and there is a little bit of signature of environmental factors, but that's not most of the issue, I think. There is more variation regarding what people choose to plant, actually, because we've been in the fields, so, and we've been sampling backyards too. And actually, there is more a much greater effect of diversity in backyards than in the fields. The first reason is really that the fields are poorer in terms of specific richness. There are less species in the fields, but in the backyards there is a high level of diversity, and it's well. We are. This is really the start of the project, and we already begin to see that we will need to do more work about that, because we see a lot of variation. There is both the common structure in backyards and the variation, and sometimes it might be linked to the economics of the owner. If he wants to sell mango jam, he will need to plant a lot of mango trees. And so you see sometimes homogeneity in terms of species, not many species, but very high density of some species. And on the other hand, there is a high diversity with single trees. And you have both, and we do not know yet why this is so, and we will probably have to do something else to understand this. And yeah, but it's very diverse. I would mean compared to the space devoted to backyards, because history is another factor in the equation. Traditionally, the backyards are very small space, because the whole Caribbean region is based on previous slave economy, and so the garden and the backyards were for slave to feed themselves in addition to the work they do during the day. So, and usually it was a very small space. So we can still see that in a way, because there are big gardens and small gardens, and I wouldn't say necessarily that bigger gardens or bigger backyards have more diversity or more trees. So it's not the only factors. And I will just say that because I think the aim was really to record the diversity first, and it's really amazing, because we can see both small effects of the environment and big effects of in the different islands, and connections that we might have to make between islands and some that don't. And yeah, at some point that will be I hope we understand how things are organized, or what are the drivers of species diversity for backyards, because most of the diversity is actually a backyard diversity, and it's really amazing in the Caribbean. Yeah.
So I kind of wonder this, when I spent time down in Arizona, especially down in the Tucson area where they have several small mountain ranges, they have the concept of sky islands where there are species that develop above a certain altitude that don't cross over very well across the desert because they don't spread like at low enough altitudes where they could move easily from one small range to another. But it kind of sounds like even within the islands in the Caribbean, there are like sub islands that you have, based on the previous economies and so forth, but also how there's slight climate variations in between different parts of the island. Does that help explain some of the diversity that you're seeing, like some sub-island effect type of thing?
Well, what I really do see with the data so far, it's really a qualitative assessment, because I did most of the sampling, is that you have connections, or you have proximity in terms of species composition, island to island, and so some falls in between two different islands. But it's apart from that, it's not really clear. And there are some islands that are really Well, really standing apart, I mean, St. Lucia, for example, you wouldn't have any backyard with grass or with a lawn. When you do have a backyard that's a bit bigger, you will have a banana crop. But to an extent, that's really amazing. And I would say, yeah, if you look at all these islands as small states who which do have to get to food autonomy, it makes sense. And I don't know exactly how they fall into the continuum between a dependence on commercial exchanges and local autonomy. I know for the French islands it's a bit low because, well, there is French support. But for small state islands, they need to feed people living there and must do, I guess, because there is not that much of the starvation issue or hunger. But there are different strategies, and what I can say is that St. Lucia, for example, really did bet on agroforestry at an amazing level. I mean, the number of trees in the fields and in the backyards is much greater compared to the other islands. And that's amazing because there is also, yeah, I meet with both with extension officers and farmers and discuss with them and see how that project would match with local island objectives. And well, there were also many, there was a strong interest in St. Lucia about agriculture and autonomy and many things. And they expected advice, but once again, we discussed it the previous times. I had to say that unfortunately, they were in a much more advanced state of the art than we were. So I would not teach them, they would teach me. And once again, so my guess is that the general philosophy in the Caribbean is that there are strategic orientations regarding agriculture and priorities are different between the different islands. And usually you get to the most advanced state of the art when you have one objective and it will just differ between islands. And then that's it. And of course, people want to get better at what they do really good already. And that's a difficult part of the job, is that usually they are better than you are yourself. So
That's certainly been my experience in doing ethnography research. It's frustrating sometimes to see people go into an area briefly and come back with strong conclusions about what people seem to be good at or what they're how to do things, and you realize that was just the first phase of your research where you're deceived by what you see mainly. It takes a few phases of research before you start to even formulate the right questions. Repeat. So in cataloging your trees, do you are you looking at the are you recording the age or size of the trees so that you could possibly see if there's a change over, say, a couple decades time in what people are planting based upon what species the old trees are versus what species the more recently planted trees are?
Yeah, well, so actually we did not, and I deeply regret it. What we do have a sense of it because we sampled new homes, so really more modern homes, and we see what kind of trees there are in the gardens and backyards, and all abandoned houses, because there are a lot, at least in Guadeloupe and Martinique, because of the history of the how you can arrange legacy and inheritance, and so there are a lot of houses that belong to a whole family, but nobody, if there is a single people not willing to sell or not willing to make the file advance to some level, it stay like this, and it's falling into ruins, but you can still investigate the species growing in these gardens. I think there are differences. Yeah, we see that. My regret is that we do not usually for new homes, people have not planted trees really, except for the classical, the baseline mango trees that is everywhere in the Caribbean. But
Right.
so that's this information we do not really have. But for abandoned houses, we can get a sense that, yeah, there were species that were more cultivated in the past compared to now. And usually these are fruit, some, at least one of them, the kinep, which is more a species for the dry areas, but you can still grow them in the tropic humid, humid tropic. It was more frequently present in the ancient gardens, and now it turned out it's an invasive species locally. At least this is under discussion. Yeah, and there are many people, especially young people, at some time of the year they sell the fruits to make a little bit of money. And yeah, so we see hints that some species were more cultivated in the past. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now I not leaving the trees necessarily, but just thinking about another slightly related topic. You obviously, these islands vary in how wet they are. And like it tends to be the islands are wetter in like the west side, it looks like to me, versus the east side, and the islands are different from each other. We have now, I think we are officially entered into an El Nino phase of the ENSO cycle, which means this is very hard to say. You can find maps online that show you maps of the world saying wetter here, drier there, colder here, warmer there. But those are really averages. The effects of El Nino, we know, is going to be increased temperature in the Atlantic. There'll be reduced organized hurricane activity, which is good for Guadeloupe, probably. But typically, a strong El Nino causes your part of the world to get drier during the summer, during the current season, the next several months. I don't know if that's been your actual experience in past El Ninos, but do you see anything happening now, and how is that going to affect things, do you think, in the next 6 months?
Well, I would say that yeah, really there are seasonal effects. And actually all the islands, at least all the mountainous islands with volcanoes, they do have an eastern part which is very humid because the clouds get stuck by the mountains and it's raining more often. And the leeward side on the west is very dry, and it's true for most islands. And sometimes also we see differences in terms of fruit species, but it's not huge. Some of the species seems to be affected, and there is usually a closely related species that can take on those sides. I've seen that in St. Vincent where, well, I'm sorry, I don't know the English names. There is Waxapaw on the drier side, and there is a similar species with bigger seeds, and which is actually slightly better, but it's all a matter of taste on the eastern side. But for most species, well, I do not see these differences. It's true that the climate change is going to affect productivity of agriculture in the Caribbean, but I would say, well, we do not really, well, we can see effects of climate changing in temperate places, but not that much in the tropical places yet, at least in the Caribbean, because that's mostly what I'm focusing on. It's true that the summer are drier or tend to be drier, and the rain tend to be more heavy in the rain season. So it's really altering the extremes or changing the extremes. I'm not sure how it would impact agriculture yet, but for sure, farmers have to match crops and the weather they get. And I would say the best way they can do that, if they want to be productive enough, is to diversify, both in terms of intraspecific diversity, agrodiversity, and between species. Because if you cannot predict what whether you will have, the safer bet is to be diverse so that you have at least one or several crops that can be productive enough. And that's probably the safest bet. But there will always be farmers who will just go on and try their things and focus more on one crop or a few crops and succeed with that. But it really has to match with the conditions, and it's really a serious bet.
Yeah, it seems, excuse me, being in an island, being islands, being in a tropical or subtropical sea helps. Being an island helps. And also, it seems like trees are buffered. So, being an island buffers you, trees are buffered naturally over climate change period or any kind of weather change a little bit. I'm understand, is there's not a lot of, is there a lot of irrigation done in these islands? Mechanical irrigation or complicated irrigation.
Actually, on the drier part of the islands, at least for the French territories, there is recourse to irrigation. I don't really know for the other islands because the way the dry place and the wet place are structured, I don't know that well enough. What I've noticed anyway is that there is a tendency for the southern islands to cultivate more higher in the mountains, and it has very strong consequences. I experienced that if you have to see a farmer and you discuss with them in their fields, and the slope is quite high, it's very easy to get down and discuss. But when you have to go out, go back, it's in terms of the physicality of the small walk, you have to it's demanding, and you have to be fit to be a farmer in the mountains, and you work on slopes, and well, the way they grow, especially tuber crops, is very impressive because it's very well designed from what I've seen. But I think there is a tendency to make a use of mountain and high altitude fields that I do not see here, for example. But we can irrigate at least as long as we do have the water resources, because the whole region has been experiencing a severe drought. Every island that I've been sampling on, people were speaking about the drought.
So there is drought. People do adapt to it. Yeah, I know what you mean. I worked in a little bit in part of what is now Democratic Republic of Congo, where agriculture was done. And that it was 100% slope, nothing flat. And people had giant legs. I mean, everyone was strong and able to go. And I could barely go up and down the hills. And I was fit. I was doing a lot of field work and I was fit at my maximum fitness. And it was hard to keep up with the children and the women. And in fact, you may be familiar with the painters' work. I think they're painters. They worked in, Nepal, looking at reproductive ecology among people living in highly sloped areas. And they, using CO2 meters, measured energy output while doing farming work among women to test for amenorrhea effects. And they found that when women were walking up and down slopes, they used a certain level of energy. But when they were carrying children and firewood or crops they had harvested, they were using less energy, not more, even though their body mass was being added to by something like 20%, 25%. And it had to do more with just the way they walked. So when you're in that kind of level of stress, you might think when the stress increases, you maximize, but really what you're doing is adjusting the exact modality that you're working with and paying more attention. So their actual oxygen use dropped when they were under more stress. Slightly. It didn't drop dramatically, but it should have gone up by a lot and it never did. So that's a whole area. Maybe you can get some colleagues in there to work on that. Laurent, the other thing you've been working on, oh, I want to ask a very specific question. You have done research that shows how fungal diseases of crops, one of the important things that you've learned to understand about them is where the funguses reside and hang out, what the reservoir is for the fungus that can affect the crops. And how that specifically, you may have already answered this question, but how that specifically can relate to immediately local weather patterns of wind and that kind of thing. Do you have, do you, I just this crazy thought occurred to me that's probably ridiculous, but I'm thinking about major storms and their ability to kind of clean out those funguses and the frequency of these large storms being changed by things like El Niño or ENSO cycles, so years in which there's lots of storms, years in which there's fewer storms. Do you think that, are you measuring that now, or do you think that there may be some negative effects or benefits from having things like more or fewer hurricanes on that fungus problem with crops?
I've made a population genetics survey of the fungus Colletotrichum in different islands a few years ago, and actually we still had holes in the genetic data file, so I was willing to fill the gaps, but eventually I was not able to secure funding for that, so I decided to proceed to analysis and publish it anyway because it was waiting for too long. And of course, recently, so it's showing very interesting patterns. And since I made this, I did analyze a bit more deeper, it's amazing because that's part of the fungal system. The Caribbean, of course, are just archipelagos, and there is a pattern of stormy weather in the rain season, which includes hurricanes, of course. And actually, that's probably what happens. It's that the fungus, usually during rain season, they just multiply. And if there is a big storm, the spores will just fly away. And most of them will die in the sea, but some of them will land in the other islands. And so, what I did not anticipate enough is that there is an island that is standing apart in the Caribbean. That's Barbados. It's a much drier place, and it's amazing because there is a strong connection, genetic connection, regarding Colletotrichum species between Barbados and the drier places in Guadeloupe. So probably there is something to dig about fitness of the fungi relating to the climate, the local climate. There might be strains that are doing very well in drier places. And in this case, Barbados is just sending spores to Guadeloupe and Martinique and the drier areas. And in places where these areas are irrigated, we spoke about it a few minutes ago, these are places where tubers are grown, and they are more sensitive to this disease specifically. So the dynamics of the system is, we will probably have to investigate a bit more in detail, because we can hypothesize, we can make the hypothesis about this in the Caribbean, but there is another phenomenon, which is the Caribbean, during the dry season and between the transition to the rain season, they are experiencing dust mist from the Sahara. And so if sand is able to cross the sea, the ocean, and go into the region, and sometimes it's going deep into Amazonia because it has a fertilizing effect, it can also transport spores and fungal spores. And so the question is also, does West Africa contribute to the genetic diversity of this fungus in the Caribbean? I would really love to be funded for a science project with African colleagues, so that we can see if that's the case, because yam is a little bit cultivated in the Sahelian Africa, but it's more often cultivated in wetter area of West Africa. But still, the dispersal process can occur, and in my opinion, it can really cross the ocean. And we it's not easy, because when we study fungal disease, because of the history of the science, we've been limiting our view of things and the processes involved. As you know, pair of species and regionality, it's very local phenomena, and we do not have yet in sciences this view that the pattern may be more complex and much broader than we are used to think about. And that's well, maybe I will be funded someday to conduct this research, because there are some countries like Ivory Coast. Ivory Coast is growing a lot of what we call water yam, which is a dominant species in the Caribbean too. Not every island. Now I've been looking at the different islands. I know that's not really true, but in at least for the French islands, there is a much greater level of cultivation of this species. So the link can easily be done, especially since this fungus, you see, that's the way we see. It's always a crop and a specific strain of the specific species of the fungus. But that's what's, you know, when the spore is landing somewhere, it has to grow. And so it's a bit more generalist as a species than we think of it. And it can still grow on fruit trees, other crops, and even in the natural vegetation. So we don't know a lot, or we don't know enough yet, but there is probably a huge thing to work out regarding the patterns of dispersal across continents.
That's fascinating, because yeah, you're right. There's a lot of, we're literally, the Amazon is literally partially fertilized by dust from the Sahara, and it's strange. To me, it's kind of strange. You learn something, like if you are a child and you touch something hot, you figure out not to do that again pretty quickly. In science, we don't learn that fast. I remember there was an evolution, the National International Evolution Conference that happens every 5 years, happened here in the Twin Cities back several years ago. And the keynote speaker, I don't remember who it was, pointed out, his point was, there is no such thing as coevolution, because coevolution was thought of as a thing that was interesting and unique and special between two species. And it turns out that everything does that all the time. It's just evolution is always interactive between the species and genomes. More recently, popularized by some science writers, people realize that there's a gut genome in humans, and of course, generally anything with an intestine. We have things going on in our, we have a genome that we link to that is not our own DNA, but that very much interacts with our very existence and survival. And you're talking about a global fungal genomic phenomenon that links, and you're thinking too small. Africa and the Caribbean. Well, what about the entire world? The wind doesn't stop at the Leeward Islands or at the Amazon. Probably the Amazon is contributing to, whatever's downwind, to New Guinea. It is an interesting idea. That sounds like a very fundable sort of project to get together. Very much so. I think that'll be really fascinating. And it's unfortunate. Well, this may be why, but that, okay, you're saying the funguses aren't that species specific. There aren't mutualisms so much between many of these funguses and the things that they live off of. Anyway, that could be why. I'm going to another topic, and I'm going to have to ask you to help me pronounce this. The folk medicine, Remed Rezier, how do you say that?
Yeah, already it's good. That's
Okay.
a yeah. Well,
And
that's
tell us about that. Tell us about your work in that area.
yeah. Well, so I'm really a geneticist, and I'm working in ecology and evolutionary ecology especially, and so I'm really not an ethnobotanist, even if that's something that's of interest to me. And recently, everyone knows there has been a huge pandemic. So COVID, yeah, there was COVID, and then there was lockdown, and well, many states decided to go for that strategy to try to limit this virus. So many scientists have had to stay home and try to think about what's next. And my personal strategy was not to work on COVID or make models of how it could alter this and this. Maybe I was wrong, but that's not what I decided to do. But I had a lot of time, if even if I had to homeschool my kids. And there was also the opportunity, because there is this journal, Economic Botany, who was about to produce a special issue specifically for the Caribbeans. And that was something I've noticed interacting with farmers, how they speak about plant species they use in traditional remedies, and people are very interested in that too. And so I decided maybe it was a good time to to breathe a little bit and do something with all the time that I had, to do something a little bit different. And everyone else was in the same situation, like staying at home. So I just and going on internet. So I've designed a survey about the traditional medicine, the local medicine known as the Razier, and I asked people on Facebook in gardener groups if they were willing to proceed to phone interviews. And well, it did not have the success that I was hoping for. So the sample size is a bit small, but it was still enough to do something about it. And that was actually very interesting. And then the lockdown was finished and people began to go back to social, greater levels of social interactions. And so I still conducted some interviews face to face. And well, it was a very basic question. What I was really willing to know is, are people using these traditional remedies or not? And how many people do, and really what kind of remedies they do? Because some of the remedies are ready for use, like teas, herbal teas, and is very popular in the world usually. Yeah, but there are also more traditional remedies like leaf baths that are directly coming from African traditions, which are still living in the Caribbean. And so I was really willing to investigate just that. It was a bit descriptive, but my question was really, okay, people are speaking about this a lot. And yeah, and it was very interesting because the results, grossly, they are that all the traditional medicine is maybe not that traditional as we think of it. It's still it's really a dynamic process. It may also have to, I'm sorry for the roosters. It may has to do with a Caribbean history of being a political mess. With if we look a few hundred years ago, like 200 years ago, the political instabilities, the trade roads, and of course the slave society. It's really a big thing. I mean, you cannot avoid it. It's very foundational to the Caribbean, in good and bad ways, and yeah. And so the Razier medicine is really a medicine traditionally based on plants that people could use where they had the right to go. And Razier means the bush, and it's really a place that was anthropized and then left back to nature. So it's not the forest, and it's not the wild places. And most of the remedies or the species that are in use in this medicine are coming from these places. And yeah, so the traditional medicine is evolving a little bit, and it make a much greater use today of what I call exotic species, like newly introduced species such as Moringa, which is an Indian species, but apparently it had a strong impact, especially when cholera was still an issue in the Caribbean. And there is also a much stronger appreciation of food as medicine, like the lemon juice you can use, the ginger, or part of the plants that are used as crops, like guava fruits. You can also use leaves to make teas. And so the pattern was really that of the greater use of food plants that are grown in the backyards too. And yeah, you see, my research has a lot of connection. The diversity of crops and the diversity of plants and backyard fields, and that's also because there is a strong continuum in the Caribbean region, and human activity is a bit of everything.
Yeah, I know, and I think I find it really interesting because, you know, to me, science, we're talking about science versus culture, right? To me, science is about, I like to describe science this way to people because I don't think that they quite appreciate it, and once it's appreciated, you understand science better. So I don't mean to define science narrowly, but science is in part the explanation of variation you observe by understanding the variation of what makes that happen. So what causes it, people tend to think about averages. So they see a phenomenon and they think of the average of the phenomenon, but the scientists really want to look at the range and the variation and to see where, what if something else you observe is within that range of variation naturally, or if it's distinct. That's what statistics is all about, right? So when I see this, your study, I read your paper, and it reminds me of a study done of snakes in, I think it was Mozambique, where the idea was just count the snakes, how many snakes are here. And the way you count snakes in an area, like anything else, you capture the animal, you mark it, you release it. And then you capture another one, you keep going until you start recapturing animals that you previously captured. Then there's a mathematical model that tells you, well, how many are out there? Once you start recapturing, that tells you a rough idea of how many are in the environment. This study went on for 2 months and they didn't ever recapture the same snake once, meaning the number of snakes in that habitat, grassland habitat, was greater than can be measured by science. You saw a really large number of species and not a lot of repetition. It's like the point of these collections of remedies is almost to have as many remedies as you can get. Or the diversity is, as you say, a result of this incredibly complex history, both of the plants themselves, especially if you have, you know, exotics and invasives, and the complexity of the traditions where people are using them. I think it would be interesting to look at recently emerged systems. So in the United States, for example, and Mike can verify this, we went from a society where there were very few traditional medicines of any kind to one in which there were a lot of people using lots and lots and lots of traditional medicines. I'm talking about Westerners in the United States. So in the 1960s, you saw very little of that. And then in the 19, you know, at present, you can go into a store and find 200 species of plants, usually in the form of a pill or a capsule in a bottle, that are all considered remedies to something. And we invented this incredibly high diversity of plant remedies as part of the New Age movement. And of course, these are all remedies that people around the world are already using, mostly. But there seems to be a cultural phenomenon that itself may be driving the diversity, because the plants supply more than enough diversity, right? Plants are extremely diverse. And then the cultural part goes in there and just capitalizes on that diversity.
Yeah, that's right. And actually, maybe not the starting point, but I remember the first time I went to the USA, my parents were working there, and so I was visiting them. And I met with a Native American, and I spoke to her about plants and the use of plants, and it was very interesting. And at some point, she told me something that amazed me a little bit, because that was not the view I had. But she said, plant species do not disappear because don't disappear because we destroy the habitats. Plants disappear because we don't use them anymore. To me, I was really a young student at that time. I was just out and beginning my scientific career, and I was very young and naive, maybe. And so I had this, you know, the old way of thinking a plant disappear because we destroy environment and things like that. But she was true that things that we use, we protect them.
Yep.
And that's the whole point of protection. Usually in the past, area, preserved area, some of these places are still managed like this, but there was no human intervention. And then people realized that villagers living near the area were experiencing or living this as a conflict with their own interests. And so we decided to have buffer zones in protected areas so that people could still use the plants. And actually, humans are still a huge species in all the ecological interactions. And it's true that part of protecting species, especially plant species, better is also allowing people to use these plants, because it has a strong impact in terms of how the population are maintained or not, the gene flow between populations, the way they mate, especially in plants, because there is a huge diversity in plant mating systems. And sometimes when human interfere with that, it's not always for the worst. Sometimes it's for the good. And there is a lot of work to do anyway about that. But yeah, with time I learned that she was much right about this. And yeah, and if I want to get back to the traditional medicine studies that I made recently, I've been amazed that there was everyone that I asked, and sometimes these were people interested in the subject, so of course they would use a traditional remedy, but sometimes they were just random people, and nearly everyone used that traditional medicine. There was not a single case of people not using it, even among randomly chosen people. And
Interesting.
yeah, so it's a very small sample. It's only 35 interviews, but everyone used the medicine in the previous year. And sometimes some people use them every week, and sometimes they use it from time to time. And there was a small dichotomy in the, well, I would say there are two populations, a population of user more relating to the traditional uses, which involves going to the wild to harvest the plants, and more modern people, more modern users, which are really depending on their gardens or families and friends to use this medicine. But that was, to me, that was really a starting point. I think there is a lot to do. And it also has to do with that when I interact with people, farmers and people, other people, nearly everyone mentioned it, even as if they don't grow that crop, if it's not an official crop. Sometimes the fields are still managed so that there is space for these species to grow there, and probably some protection levels, active protection levels by people.
Yeah, it's interesting. I obviously, you and I both read up and done research on related topics, that the human-plant interaction isn't just people exploiting and destroying plants. We are enhancing their frequency or altering them constantly. This I don't, before we run out of time, I want to get to another topic which I think is really interesting and important that you've been working on, and that is the, just to characterize it, in agriculture or plant and plant production, and as it applies to animals as well, there's kind of two ends of the spectrum. In one end, you're doing mostly monoculture, large scale, industrialized, even you might even have corporate sponsors running farms. You're mainly in the Leeward Islands, you're mainly maybe growing sugarcane or something. In Minnesota, it's corn, which is basically sugarcane with kernels. And the alternatively, you're doing something we would define more as horticulture, where you're growing a diversity of plants, a diversity and animals. You have a enough in a horticultural region that you could actually use this as your diet, as opposed to a monoculture where you can't live off a single species. And it's despite people wishing it otherwise, on a calorie per calorie basis, you're probably going to get more production out of the monoculture agriculture than out of horticulture. But in terms of the diversity of what you get a better ecology with horticulture. So do you put all your plants in intensive agriculture and reduce the amount of agricultural land that you use so you have wild lands to have your ecological diversity preserved? Or do you use more land to grow the same food, but you have a more ecologically friendly horticulture? Talk about that for a minute.
That's a huge issue. But well, I think maybe I will have the non-consensual opinion on that. Because I,
It's
of course,
probably worth mentioning this could be a very political discussion, so feel free to generalize.
Yeah. Well, first of all, what I would like to say is that my actual opinion is that we need diversity as a technological mix anyway, which is I do not favor specific. I have preferences, but I'm not saying we should have all or nothing ways of producing foods. And sometimes the industrial way will be better, sometimes not. And I think the answer is to find a way to have a mix of everything that we can do. And this includes ways of doing agriculture that are less popular, at least in the scientist community, or that are popular for the wrong reasons, or things, yeah. So this is very my first point. I do not have a strong opinion at all regarding the issue, but I still have preferences. And of course, my own experience and my own research activity leads to the same stable po endpoint, which is if you diversify, you of course you will have less productivity in the best crop you can aim for. That's what we call realized productivity, which is really something that's theoretical. To achieve that, you would have to have the perfect cropping system in the perfect, in the most perfect conditions. But even natural conditions, even field conditions are never meeting these. And so if you aim for more diversity, whatever the level of diversity you aim for, you can average your expected productivity. And if you cannot bet what crop will produce best, that's a better way to bet on diversity. And I'm experiencing it as a pseudo a farmer because I'm doing a lot of farming myself, even if I do not have the constraint of having it economically viable. But as I do see it in my experiments too, and I do see it. Usually, the happiest farmers are also those currently who are diversifying. So, if you stick to the old way, it works only in some conditions. And since these conditions are may not be met in the future, you better have to change your ways. But usually, yeah, I can speak a lot about this. And I know there is a debate, a strong debate in the agricultural community, and well, diversity protection community, which is should we intensify agriculture so as to free more space devoted to wild nature left at itself? Or should we increase land sharing and so coexistence between wild nature and agricultural activities? And I've been giving a look yesterday about literature. At this point, I think the land sparing has more people thinking that's a good way, and I'm still half convinced by what I've read. It really depends on whether you're looking at big animals and megafauna, or if you're looking at all the diversity that science has been traditionally overlooking, like fungus, insects, and small animals on plants. And this is a huge debate in itself. I mean, just, I don't know if we can really get
Yeah.
to
I think one of the things that, and I just heard this morning on a video I was watching, that like Norman Borlaug's Green Revolution enabled much increase in production of cereal grains and various agricultural products, but in doing so, it actually changed the way that we produce food so that modern wheat, corn, and so forth has less amount of nutritional value compared to what it was before the Green Revolution. And so I understand what you're saying there as far as it really is not a set of easy answers on how we can change the way that we do agriculture to feed more people. If we're producing more food, but it has less caloric or nutritional value, then we really haven't gained as much as we thought, it seems like.
That's true. Anyway,
Since Google has found out that I have diabetes, it feeds me a whole bunch of different conflicting
well,
YouTube videos as far as what types of food are nutritionally good and what are bad, so it's really kind of hard to sift through for a layperson, without the expertise that somebody may have that in food production, to really understand what actually is good for us and what is bad for us. So the volumes of food that we have to produce in order to feed a growing population just are is a seriously confounding factor.
So the issue regarding nutrition is, of course, that we need to have a high diversity in our diets, and that's still best to have this diversity because it's also diversity in nutrients. And to stay healthy, you have to diversify your own diet. The issue is how do production systems translate into high diversity availability in diets? And we can have different ways to do that, is specializing in single crops and proceed to monoculture and then have high levels of productivity. But it's still not clear that we can achieve the most proceeding with monoculture. We have the most of one crop, but even in smaller farms with a lot of work available, productivity can sometimes, in some conditions, be greater than in monoculture setting. It's not even that clear cut. And if after that, if it's the way you buy consumers buy the food, there are many ways to get back to a diversified diet. And of course, this will also vary between different regions. And I think in the Caribbean, there is a specific issue that we can do most of the things that we can produce a lot of things and a great diversity locally. And we should aim for that. And actually, that's what people aim for. I mean, most consumers, they want to consume local. And it's already here. And we do have a lot of resources. But organizing the whole thing is a bit complex, and it can be done by policies, by incentives, by many ways, and I'm really not an expert into these questions. But at least from the farming standpoint, we know that monoculture is not, it's good for reaching high levels of productivity, but it's not sustainable in time. It's degrading the field itself, the nature of the soil, and the way disease declare in crops. And many studies aim at reintroducing diversity either at the species level, which is mixing varieties in single fields, or intercropping with other species. And so basically, I think that's unavoidable. You cannot avoid that. You will have to go back to high diversity levels, even just so to ensure sustainability in the long term, anyway. That's a bit a general conclusion, but obviously there are not that many other ways to do that other than diversifying. We can still do that at the regional level. We can still achieve that via rotation, but ultimately we will have to get back to something more diverse anyway.
One approach we're using in the Midwest in the US now is it's called forever green agriculture. So it's interesting. If you look at a map of Minnesota, for example, every month of an agricultural region, you'll see many months the map is white because it's covered with snow. And for about 7 weeks, 8 weeks, it's covered with green because you've got a crop growing there. And for 3 months, 4 months, it's brown because the crop is dead. In fact, the crops are killed intentionally. It's called termination. A chemical is put on the fields to kill anything that's growing there at the end of the season. And then it remains brown until it becomes white, and then you plant in the spring. So we're using the land for a fourth or a third of the time. and during a fourth or a third of the time, it's eroding. So the idea is there are these crops that grow low to the ground so that you can grow things in between and still use machines. And it reduces your productivity of the main crop you're growing, say potatoes or something, by about 20% at most. But it decreases your input of fertilizer and other chemicals enough that that the actual net price of the crop that you're selling is significant, is 10, 15% higher. And then long term, and then if you're lucky, this cover crop right now, the ones that are most commonly used, produce a seed that makes an oil that we don't use for anything. Not particularly, it's actually not, it's actually not edible, but they're working on making it more edible, and they're working on using this oil for things like in industry. So, and there's other edible crops as well. So that's not monoculture, except it is, and it's not diversity, except it is. It's sort of adding two species, maybe, dropping back overall productivity of your main crop, but increasing the value of the land, decreasing chemical input for and eliminating erosion. And I've had conversations with farmers extensively about this, and the reason why it's not more widely adopted in Minnesota than it could be is simply for one reason. If you are a farmer and you want to hook yourself up with an industrial company and say, "I'll grow your corn," they'll fix you up. They'll give you the money, the loans, you'll have corn. If you're a farmer and you want to do any of these things, you're on your own entirely, even though you will make more money. So it's basically how brave is your farmer, and how savvy are they about using these techniques. So therefore, we're passing laws. We just passed some laws this year. We're making it more viable. We're funding it. We're making it some. We're going to expand it considerably, and our objective is to have cover crop farming over most of our farming in Minnesota within the next decade or so. So it's being done everywhere,
Another
mostly.
advantage on that, Greg, is people forget how much carbon dioxide is exposed and released into the atmosphere from plowing and turning the soil, and that reduces the turning of the soil. So it does allow the soil to retain more of the carbon dioxide
Yes.
than standard practices.
Interestingly, we have arguments about that. That is absolutely, what you said is absolutely true. It retains carbon dioxide. It retains carbon in the soil. And a major source of carbon in the atmosphere is carbon we've released from lands through agriculture. It's hard to put that forward. Right now, we're having a rhetoric battle, a messaging battle, because when you put that forward as one of your main ideas, people will counter and say, "Yeah, but it's a small amount." The thing, it is a small amount. The problem is, how much carbon in the atmosphere makes a difference? A small amount. So we're only 100 parts per million more than we want to be. If you can reduce from now on every year one part per million, that means in a century we fix climate change from that one thing you did. If you do 10 things like that means in a decade we fix climate change. So small amounts matter, because there's a lot of little small amounts. That's what horticulture is, right? Anyway, we're getting off the topic. Anyway, Laurent, our hope in the United States and other places is that we understand the genetic and biological, cultural, horticultural, and geographical and contextual variation in crops and plants, and better, so that we can do a better job in feeding ourselves and keeping the planet healthy. And it's exactly your research and the kind of research you do that helps us do that. I've always been an admirer of your research, as you know, and I think you should get a lot more funding.
Okay. Yeah, I would definitely like to have more funding for specific projects, but I'm not underfunded. It's just that sometimes I would like to have questions that are less popular. And well, but
Right.
it's, yeah, that's still a way of doing things, and you can, and things are evolving. I mean, I'm clearly not pessimistic regarding science funding. But still, it's a way we proceed to evaluating projects, and the same way we produce science, and it really depends on the jury evaluating the proposal, and sometimes they have other priorities, and sometimes they even have political priorities to sustain. And it's all a bigger part of a bigger conversation and discussion that we all have. And it's important to have them so that the words can reach the most people, and everyone discusses and take part of these discussions, not only scientists, but everyone should be discussing these issues and make them of their everyday life, especially when it comes to food, because food is still something that we will need in a in the future. So it's
Yes.
important to discuss all these issues.
I agree. And this has been a great discussion. Mike, do we have anything else you want to follow up? I think we're kind of good on time.
I think we're getting close to the time that we had talked about. I know that you had something at 11:30, right, Laurent? So, yeah, it's been a great discussion. And anytime that you want to have a discussion with us, Laurent, just let me know because I learn so much from listening to you. And I think that our audience enjoys the opportunity as well. So thank you very much for contacting us and asking to be on. It's been my pleasure.
Okay, my pleasure too.
Well, I want to thank both Greg and Laurent for participating in that discussion. I had a great time listening and contributing to it. I also want to thank you, the listeners, for staying with us. I know that we don't put out podcasts as often as we'd like to, but when we do, we get good discussions out of them. The next one will be a discussion that Greg and I have over nuclear power, the pluses, the minuses, and whether or not it's possible to replace our energy grid based on carbon using nuclear fuel. After that, we're going to be talking to Marlene Zuck about two books she's recently written. And both of them have a common theme of misunderstandings and misuses of science. So look forward to those as well. That should be up hopefully within a few weeks. Thank you very much, and thanks again for listening to Iconocast.
Thank you.